Hey everyone, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems and BikeJames.com, and welcome to another edition of the Bike James podcast. Today I got a special guest on with me. His name is Jukka Mainena. He is Finnish and he is a cycling coach as well. And I've known Jukka actually for quite a while through just talking with him through my blog and emails and stuff. And he's actually made his way out to my facility to do some training. And recently we were talking about some stuff that he had learned recently. I wanted to talk to him about it more and figured I'd get him on the podcast to do it. So Jukka, how's it going, buddy?
Doing good. Thanks for the introduction, and it's an honor to be here and get to talk to you. Thanks.
Yeah, no problem, man. Glad to have you on. Like I said, I mean, you're only 29, so you're still pretty young, but I mean, you're already a pretty accomplished coach and rider. I mean, you've been riding for, you know, 15 years. You do everything from downhill to BMX freestyle. You know, you're kind of focusing on BMX racing and enduro riding right now, but you know, definitely a pretty varied background in cycling, both from a personal approach, you know, racing yourself, and also helping other athletes, you know, excel as well. And because of this, this is really cool. You know, you were approached about writing a book about cycling, and so you're recently a published author with a book called the Big Finish Cycling Book, and pretty much goes over everything that talks about cycling. And so I definitely wanted to get you on and talk a little bit about the book and some of the things that you went over in that. But so I guess just kind of, you know, kicking things off there, you know, kind of what would you say is your general, you know, coaching and training philosophy when it comes to helping riders get better on their bikes?
Well, that's a good question, but I like to think that we're all human beings first, then second, like athletes, and when it comes to like sports specific performance. So even though you might be a hockey player, cyclist, mixed martial artist, whatever, you need to have the basics down when it comes to strength, mobility, endurance, stuff like that. So that's like where I get started. And depending where the athlete or person is, like do an assessment, some sort of, then get going from there. If you see some like really big gaping holes in a way when it comes to mobility, for example, with cyclists, you want to address that. And usually things fall into place pretty nicely.
Yeah. Well, you know, mobility is an interesting thing that you bring up, because it's something that, it's funny, I think it's getting more popular. People are getting more aware of what they need, that they need to be doing some mobility training, but I don't think enough cyclists really appreciate exactly how much mobility can help them and what kind of things that they should be doing. So I guess just kind of touching on the mobility stuff, I mean, what, you know, if you're talking to a cyclist and saying, hey, man, here are the things that mobility is going to help you do better as a rider and help improve your performance, I mean, what would you tell them?
Well, first of all, it's something like you can see it from the posture. For example, myself, I'm not the poster boy when it comes to mobility or posture or anything like that, but I try to work on it pretty much every day, and I just feel a tons of better. If I skip it a day or two, I can definitely feel it. And sometimes you can see like even jumps in performance when you fix big things like hip mobility, for example, like the active straight leg raise. If someone can't get their legs like barely off the ground, well, that's a red flag for sure. And in general, like as a cyclist, you don't need like a ton of mobility, but just like to have the basics in order, at least. That's where I'd like start with.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess kind of jumping into it, I know you and I have talked about this. This is one of the subjects I really wanted to pick your brain on, and we have some other things that we can dive into. But since we're talking about the mobility stuff, and I really want to talk to you about this, I think that one of the things that keeps a lot of riders from using mobility more effectively is knowing what to do, and that it's more than just doing some static stretching. And so you've recently been getting into some really cool mobility-based programs. And so I wanted to pick your brain on those a little bit. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the what you've been getting into lately and some of the things that you've learned from it. And like I said, I definitely want to pick your brain on some of this stuff.
Well, the two systems that I've been studying, they're called FRC, functional range conditioning, and the second one is brand new. It's called KinStretch. They're both systems by this chiropractor, all around badass guy, Andrea Spina. And basically, it's like, well, let's start with the FRC. It's like system that's developed to improve mobility, not just flexibility. And I really like the principles behind it. There are lots of like different type of drills and exercises that you can use that are introduced in the course, but the principles are what like are the main part of it. For example, if you when you think about different type of tissues, when the load exceeds the capacity of the tissue, that's where injury happens. After that, you have to do something with a really small load that's way below the capacity of the tissue, and that's called rehab. And with proper training, you can actually get the capacity of the tissue way bigger than the loads usually are. And that's injury prevention and performance enhancement. So that's like a really nice summary. And what it's really like shines in is the drills and exercises that you really use the end ranges of motion, the end ranges in the range of motion. And you have to apply controlling there. So there are lots of like, you don't really need like external resistance. You can work do a lot of work with just with your body weight. So just exploring the extreme range of motion and doing different types of movements, drills, that's like the main part of it. And you can do it in a progressive manner. That's really important. You just can't, you know, hammer the nail in straight from the get-go. That's like a some kind of summary, at least.
Yeah,
Make
okay. So just kind of
sense?
yeah, just make sure that I understand and make sure everybody's kind of following along that might be listening. So with the tissues, you're talking like muscle tissues or connective tissues.
Both, definitely both. So,
And just exceeding their capacity as far as like either their range of motion or their ability to control tension within a range of motion or overstressing, is that pretty much it?
I'd actually say both. And usually, where the capacity is exceeded, it's in the end ranges of motion, and it can like usually it means that the tissue isn't like it isn't trained in that position, so that makes it weak. And they had a saying there in the course that you're gonna regret the position you got injured in since you haven't trained it. So there's and with that train of thought, you can actually like see a really good point of doing like exercises with improper alignment and stuff like that. We're talking about valgus squats and things of that nature. But that's pretty advanced stuff, but makes sense when you think about it.
No, for sure. I definitely it's definitely something that in looking at it, it looks really similar to just kind of the principles behind dynamic mobility, which is that like just having your being able to do a hamstring stretch for example is one thing, but being able to actually like control the muscle throughout that full range of motion is another, and that if you actually have a passive range of motion that you don't have active control of, that represents a potential injury spot for you within your sport. And if you get kind of stretched to that extreme range and your muscle isn't able to control it, so yeah, I mean, is that pretty much again? Just kind of, I guess we're kind of saying the same thing in a little bit different way.
Yeah, exactly. And especially if there's a big discrepancy between the active and passive ranges of motion, that's maybe not a red flag, but even at least there's like a thing that you should like consider in the future.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think that's especially important. One of the things that I don't think that a lot of riders really appreciate as far as like what strength and mobility does for them, you know, when we're talking general cycling is one thing, but you know, this podcast is mainly for mountain bikers. And I think that, you know, mountain bikers, BMX riders, like basically if you're going to crash, if you are in a riding discipline where crashing is a reality of the situation, right? And I remember there's this saying, like, there's two kinds of riders out there, those that have crashed and those that are waiting to crash. So
well said.
Yeah. So everyone's going to crash. If you're a mountain biker, you're going to go down. And when you wreck, like, your best armor, one is muscle, and one of your best injury prevention things is good mobility that you have control of. So like if your arm or leg gets stretched into an extreme position during like a ragdoll wreck, or just something gets twisted up with your bike when you wreck, you know, you're much less likely to get injured if you have a little muscle to take an impact and you have good range of motion that you have some active control of when that happens. And so I think that's just that it's extremely important for a lot of different reasons, but I think that's one thing that a lot of riders don't appreciate is how much it'll help from an injury prevention from a crashing standpoint as well.
Yeah, that's an important point. And usually when people think about injury prevention, it's only or all about muscles, and yeah, those are really important part, as you said, but then there's this connective tissue, we're talking about ligaments, stuff like that, and they adapt to different type of stressors as well. A really good example is like wrist mobility. Someone complains that their wrist hurts when they're doing push-ups, and that's like a really bad thing. If you have to take a fall on your hands, I don't want to do that with a wrist that can't do a push-up.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think that's one of those things that a lot of riders don't appreciate is how the health versus fitness thing. It's like, you know, you may be able to ride your bike and not, you know, some of these things don't, you don't feel them necessarily. It's like, hey, I don't feel my wrist when I'm on my bike. But when you do a basic thing, like you said, like doing a push-up or just having to like get up off of the ground and all of a sudden your wrist is hurting you, like, yeah, that's a huge red flag that something's wrong and you need to fix that, not just keep plowing ahead with, you know, more miles on the bike and just keep focusing on the sport-specific stuff, which is extremely important. I mean, that's the balancing act, right? It's like you're not going to make a better rider in the gym, realistically, but you can certainly help improve their potential in the gym.
Yep.
So, well, cool, man. So what's the kin stretch? Is that, I guess, what is that? Is that kind of a specific application of some of these principles?
Yeah, it's kind of, definitely it's an application, but it's really hard to describe with just words. And when you see a video, videos, it makes a lot more sense. Hopefully you can add some links.
Yeah. Just so everyone is listening, I will have links to these videos. So
it's kind of like active stretching when you're exploring end range movement. And there's a lot of like active work involved. So every time you change a position, you're doing it actively with your own muscles, and you try to get like squeeze in every inch and every like degree of movement when you can. So it's quite a bit of work, to be honest. And it's where it really shines, I think it's like hip mobility stuff, even like ankle mobility, but hip mobility especially. And most of the stuff is actually really demanding. And the guy who's behind it, Andrea Spina, he said it so well that there's a huge market for non-yoga. And that describes it pretty well. And most of all, it's pretty damn fun. I can easily spend like 20 minutes and I feel that I just like get started. And how it works is that the people who have been in the certification or in the course, they can offer like classes that last up to an hour. And it's still like in the launch phase, I think. So there isn't a ton of material around in the web, but it's going to be big, I think, and later on in the future.
Yeah. You sent a couple of videos along with one of your emails,
yeah.
and I was taking a look at it, and it definitely looked really interesting. And so yeah, we'll have the links to those that people can check out and learn more, because yeah, like I said, I think that people having good resources for effective mobility work is extremely important, because yeah, you get a lot of people who just like start doing some static stretching, or you know, maybe they just go take a yoga class, which nothing
yeah.
against yoga, but like, you know, you may not necessarily be fully prepared for jumping into a yoga class, and doing some more specific stuff might help. So how is this, like, I guess, how are you applying this with your athletes, and you know, how has this kind of affected some of the stuff you were doing? Like, you know, what are you doing differently, I guess, as a result of learning some of this stuff?
Well, some of the FRC stuff, I use those in warm-ups. For example, there's this concept of called CARS, which is an abbreviation of words controlled articular rotation, and basically means that you explore all the joints and the end ranges of movement from head to toe, if you like. So let's say you start with the neck, move from down from the shoulder to the shoulders, thoracic spine, hips, knees, ankles. That's like 5 to 10 minutes of work, and you're actually pretty warm up even after that. And you're gonna do some more specific stuff after that if you like. And I don't do that like every time I train, but I try to squeeze in every day like a bunch session, just like 5 minutes, getting like the juice is going, as they say. And that's one thing. And when it comes to kin stretch stuff, I use those in warm-ups as well, and as well as cool downs. When you really like explore the different movements, focus on breathing, it has a really nice calming effect after a training session. And then there's the option of doing a whole session like by itself. That's I usually place it on my like rest or recovery day. I might do like anything between 20 minutes to an hour, and I can see that there's progress. It's slow, but there is definitely progress, and it's a lot of fun. And the feeling after that, it's pretty awesome. And how I apply that to clients, riders, I take like specific drills or exercises and just like, hey, have a go, and how do you feel? Do you think, and do they feel that it's like beneficial? Are there like clear movement restrictions and stuff like that? So that's like the basic answer. And one thing that's worth pointing out is that FRC is a bit different than, for example, in FMS. FMS looks like the whole movement pattern, and the FRC basically asks, is the joint working? Does it do what it is supposed to do? And if you have a stuck ankle, it truly messes up your squat. And in FMS, you see that person can't squat, but in FRC, they check like every joint, is the range, you know, in a good level, and go from there. So it's like having a perspective of being like a global or like local in joint level. That's like a pretty good description, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I like that. Yeah, for people that aren't familiar, the FMS stands for functional movement screen.
Sorry for not clearing that up.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, it's something I use and talk about, so I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with it just from me talking about it. But yeah, that's a screening system that's been around and proven itself to be pretty effective over the course of many, many years. And so, but yeah, that's a good description, because like you said, they're basically looking more at kind of gross movements, and then I guess having a system to break down into the joints themselves is a good yin and yang way to approach the whole thing. So Yeah, excellent, man. Now that's really good. That's cool. So, I guess kind of moving on, and we can, if this comes back up, we can, jump back into the mobility stuff anytime. But I wanted to definitely talk to you about your BMX racing and background and how you feel that that's helped your mountain biking and vice versa, because I think it's really important. I think too many riders look at road cycling as the best source of training inspiration, when I think that mountain biking probably has a little bit more in common with BMX, when you really break it down from the movement and metabolic and skills training demands, than it necessarily does with road riding. So gaining lessons from guys like yourself that have crossed over to both sports, I think really there's a lot to learn from that. So I wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting area, and I agree with that there are probably more similarities between BMX racing and mountain biking. First of all, a lot of top riders, for example, in downhill and even in road riding, they have a BMX racing background. If you've been racing when you were younger, as a kid, or maybe even like adolescent, whatever, you will have the bike skills for sure.
Yeah.
And like really good examples are like Aaron Green, Mitch Robellato, guys like that. They all have a racing background. I actually even heard that Mitch Robellato didn't know how to use a front brake for the like first month when he was getting into mountain biking, which is pretty fun. But when it comes like the riding skills, the bike handling skills, the racers are probably the best ones out there, in my opinion. And when it comes to pumping and like pure power and just being able to pedal the bike, racers are among the top cyclists out there, besides like track cyclists, I think. Some of the peak power outputs are like over 2,000 watts in the BMX racers, which is a lot. And besides that, they can like pedal like really high cadences as well. So that's like a really like impressive thing in my opinion. So they're like pure anaerobic power athletes. And when you apply really good like bike handling skills on top of that, it's like really effective combination. And when you have those in place, you can add endurance on top of that pretty easily. But if it doesn't work the other way around quite as easily, unfortunately.
Yeah. No, I can totally see that. I think, again, one of those things that a lot of riders don't appreciate is how big a part skills play in your overall endurance, because the better your skills are, the more efficient you are, and your efficiency is a huge part of your endurance. So your ability to, really sip on your gas tank and not waste a lot of energy with inefficient movement is a big part of it. So yeah, having the skills side of it and the kind of the high-end anaerobic conditioning, like you said, that's something I've noticed as well. I think that's one of the reasons that if people look at what's happening on the Enduro World Series, the guys who are doing the best have a downhill background, not a cross-country background. And same thing on the women's side. And the reason for that is because same things that you were touching on, like the downhillers are more like the BMX racers in the mountain biking world, where it's, really high-end anaerobic power and conditioning and really high technical skill levels. And then you can add in the endurance on top of that pretty
Yeah, you
easily.
can add a bigger engine pretty easily, but when it comes to learning the bike handling skills, it's a longer process for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's something that's funny. Before we started the podcast, we were talking a little bit about jiu-jitsu, which I've been getting into lately, and we were talking about how in the jiu-jitsu world, drilling and training is just something that you do, and that you run into people who just want to roll, which is the equivalent of just wanting to ride. But how I wish the mountain biking world would drill that. And I guess you probably find the same thing in the BMX world, where it's like, man, you don't just race. Like, you need to work on your skills. You need to work on your gait starts. You need to do these things, build the parts that are going to make the whole better, and that's what gets you to the top. And I think mountain bikers don't get that message enough and don't really appreciate it enough.
That's a really good distinction, and especially in BMX racing, the racing part is actually pretty small, like in a time scale or time-wise, since most of the track time it's used for doing different kind of drills, manuals, pumping different type of lines, exploring the different options in the track and stuff like that, doing gate starts. And racing and doing full laps, that's like hard work. That's 45 second full effort. And you can do those like five or six in a day at most. And after that, you're pretty much done. Or yeah, you can ride more, of course, but the intensity just isn't there. And if you want to get better as a racer, there's not much point doing like laps with 80% or something like that. So it's all about doing drills, getting the bike handling skills down and stuff like that. So that's a good distinction. You really go to of course you want to have fun on your bike. That there's no question about it, but there's a good distinction for just like having going for a trail ride on a mountain bike. That's a big difference.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it goes back to that, what, like the talent code and talent is overrated. Those books and kind of what they talked about, how like really the secret to performing your best is deliberate practice, and the deliberate practice may not be fun, and that your ability to kind of grind through and find meaning in things that aren't fun are going to allow you to achieve levels of fun that you wouldn't have been able to achieve without that focused practice. And so, yeah, the whole goal is to have fun for sure. But I agree with you. That's the thing. I tell riders, it's like, man, training will help you have more fun. And they're like, well, I'm already having fun. And it's like, oh man, there's just layers, there's levels of fun that you don't even know exist because you can't access them with your current strength and mobility and skill levels. And like, I know you're having fun, but like, you don't know how much fun you could be having, kind of thing. So, yeah, man, no, I think that's, some really good, some good points that mountain bikers can definitely take from BMX racing. So yeah, so any other just kind of thoughts from the BMX world that mountain bikers might be able to benefit from? I do actually want to point out real quick, I found it was real interesting that you said 5 to 6 race laps and you're pretty much done. And when I was working with Aaron Gwynn, he told me that he does about 3 to 5 practice laps when he's, at a race, getting ready for a race. So on practice day, the numbers are pretty similar. That 5 range, give or take, is
Yeah, that
about.
5 to 6 is pretty much the upper limit. You can do more, but the times they just drop off quite dramatically
Yeah,
from
and you're
week
accumulating a lot of fatigue. Like, I think that's something a lot of top level riders understand, is that they would rather show up a fresh and maybe a little underprepared, if that's the word. Like, maybe they don't have the course or the track as memorized, but they're fresh, rather than having spent all that time just memorizing everything and then showing up a little tired and beat up. And that the trade-off isn't worth it, most of the time. So yeah. But anyways, yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I when you said that number popped in my head. I just found it interesting that number is kind of consistent with downhill racing and BMX racing. But anyways, like you were saying, anything else we can, the BMXers can teach us?
Well, actually, one thing that comes to mind is especially for younger riders that are like, we're talking about like ages between less than 18 or 15 even. So if you wanna develop speed and power, you need to start early on. And after a certain age, there's well, you can always improve yourself, but like the window opportunity has kind of like closed in a way. So, and I get ask a lot of from parents that, okay, when we're gonna like develop endurance and stuff like that. But I don't worry about it that much. If in a race someone, you know, can have a really good gait start and they're leading them after the first turn, first straight, it's really rare to see someone like really gas out on the last straight. It doesn't happen actually. So having the speed and power, bike handling skills, and later on building the endurance on top of that, that's the way to go about it, I think. That's like a really big thing that I've noticed, and a lot of the coaches that are more experienced than me have like said.
That's really interesting, because we you know, there's a high school league that started gotten pretty popular and doing a really good job of getting kids into mountain biking, but it's mainly centered on cross country riding. And so it just kind of makes me think a little bit, like, you know, if you have a younger kid who's into cycling and you're trying to think about development on a bigger level, you know, one, you shouldn't be letting kids specialize anyways too early, but maybe making sure that you're getting them in some BMX racing or something that's explosive to kind of offset the endurance training at the young age. Because like you said, it's so easy to put that engine in place, you know, later than it is to develop the power and stuff. So, kids are always an interesting topic, which actually kind of transitions into something you don't actually have on your list. But I was talking with another BMX coach recently, and we were actually talking about kids in BMX racing and clipless and flat pedals, and
we're talking about Jake, right?
Jake, yes, yep. Exactly, yeah, that Jake Stefanich, yeah, I had him on the podcast as well, so there'll be an interview with him running at some point. But but I wanted to get your take, you know, just kind of on flats and BMX racing. And he also mentioned something that I found interesting. I guess at like the masters level, there's actually kind of a bit of a controversy with a lot of the guys calling to, like, hey man, let's just race in flats you know, not even worry about the clipless pedals. And so I guess I kind of wanted to get your take, just, you know, again, you having a perspective from the BMX world on those subjects.
Yeah, I have a pretty unique background in a way that I've ridden a lot of freestyle BMX, and I've done that for like more than 10 years. And it's pretty obvious that you're not clipped in when you ride freestyle. So I have clipless pedals, but I can't say that I can use them. I'm scared as hell, to be honest. And yeah, you can learn, you know, how to use them and stuff. But so far, the benefits that I feel that I've got out of them, they're like really minimal. And when it comes to like some of the benefits, it's what I've noticed is that if you're like pedaling with really high RPMs, then you don't have to think that is the shoe gonna be on the pedal just right, stuff like that. So you can really like concentrate on spinning the legs as fast as possible. That's one plus. But for example, when it comes to gait starts, acceleration, yeah, you can, in a way, like say that the pulling motion could help, but I don't buy it. It's all about pushing down with the lead leg, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, science backs that up too. This conversation drives me nuts with people because
it's pretty much a dead horse already.
It should be, but it's not, unfortunately. You get people that like just kind of go like, I don't know if I buy it. And it's like, the science is there. It's not a matter of buying it or not. Like, the references are there. So anyways, you're totally right with that.
It's usually true, whether you like it or not.
Exactly. It may be controversial and it may be unpopular, but it is there. So, it should be, but yeah, it is. The pulling up isn't as big a deal as you, as people might think. But,
And to continue about kids and younger riders, I think it's really, really important to have the bike handling skills mastered and learned with flat pedals. And if you have a kid riding with clipless pedals too early, they skip a lot of important steps. And yeah, you can correct it later on probably, but why to do it in the first place.
Yeah, it's like
and
that.
One thing why kids start using them too early is, yeah, they figure out themselves, hey, that other kid is, you know, using plus pedals, he's getting some kind of advantage or something like that, and the parents think just about the same. And I think in Europe, they have a rule that anyone under 16 or 15 isn't allowed to use clipless pedals in races, which is quite
awesome.
Amazing in my opinion.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think that that's actually something I know isn't going to make
up the playing field. And
it does. It takes the pressure away.
Have a chance to learn correct skills.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally. You're absolutely right. That is something that that we should consider doing. That's, I know it's something that won't make me super popular, but it's one of the kind of the negative side effects I've seen from the increased popularity of the high school racing leagues, which is that kids feel the pressure to get on this specialized equipment right away. Because like you said, they look over at the starting line and here's this guy on this, you know, carbon fiber 29er bike with clipless pedals. And in their mind, that kid's gaining an advantage. And so now they feel the pressure to go get it. And now, you know, like you said, they're missing these windows of opportunity to develop skills. But I think more importantly, too, I mean, honestly, the feet are so underappreciated as far as their importance to the body and a healthy brain and healthy development. Like if you read guys like Phil Maftone, who's really big in the endurance, running endurance scene. Man, he has entire sections of his books dedicated to the foot and how important it is to. He rails about kids and how important it is to get them out of shoes and let their feet develop and how it'll actually interfere with their learning and stuff like that. And so when you're strapping these kids who are still developing in, you know, these shoes and these small pedals that are completely unnatural for them and, you know, encouraging them to use unnatural movements, like, I think that it will actually have potential long-term effects on their athletic and overall development, and that it's not a good idea, and that for just several reasons, you know, like you said, kids under 16 shouldn't be allowed to use clipless pedals in racing situations, that it would be better for the cycling world in general. But yeah, it's good to hear you say that too, man, because I think it's definitely an issue.
Yeah, and one thing I want to mention about when it comes to kids, I just read this really good book about physiology, training, anything related to that, and there's a whole large chapter about training, you know, kids and adolescents, and there was this really clear concept that you want to have like a polarized training, which means you want to do things really fast, really explosive, and on the other side you do like really slow, steady state stuff, not like really slow, but clearly like aerobics type stuff.
Yeah.
So you don't really want to hammer in the lactic stuff before puberty or anything like that, because yeah, kids can handle it, but they can't like develop it in any like substantial manner. So that's one thing to keep in mind, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think with kids, it's real important to just let them play their sport, not let them specialize too early, so they're getting a variety of movements and things involved. And then if you have kids who are motivated to train, I mean, I think that's another thing, like, you know, after a certain age, this is just my opinion, I think like after about like 12, 13, yeah, maybe you can like, come on, dude, you need to do something to help yourself out. But before that, you want to be really careful. You don't want to kill a kid's motivation to train later by forcing a 10-year-old into some hardcore training routine. But if you have a 10-year-old who's motivated, even then, it's like just basic movements. Just you know, get them moving, get them crawling, get them skipping, just basic stuff. Keep it super basic and let them play their sports. So, yeah, I'm sure it's the same all around the world, but it's a huge problem here in the States with the, you know, parents getting their kids into sports and really trying to live vicariously through them by, you know, hey, here's my little future champion, and, you know, at 10 years old, look at him go, kind of thing, you know. And so anyway, it's kind of funny. Well, cool. So what about the like I said, the master's class controversy thing? Is that, are you up on that? Or I found that kind of interesting.
Actually, we don't have that in here.
Oh, okay.
Not that I've noticed. It's I can imagine it being pretty big in the States,
Yeah.
but for us it's in Finland, and I think even in Europe it's still like pretty small,
Okay.
if even like non-existent. But I can see the point, definitely.
Yeah, he said it's funny, like, you know, once these guys get to the like kind of the master's class and they're all like, look, man, we're all good enough on flats. Like, let's just call BS on this charade. You know, I'm over this thing. Let's just, he said there's a few holdouts that are like, no, I need my clipless pedals. But he said it's kind of funny, like the majority of guys are like, dude, let's just ditch the clipless and raise flats. And so but anyways, it's kind of interesting talking to him about the history of flats and BMX and how, like, you know, really wasn't that long ago, you know, in the grand scheme of things, that you would still find flats at you know, high level races and that and stuff like that. And you'll still find, I guess there's races where guys just they're flats only, and the times really aren't that far off from what guys are doing on clipless, if they're that off at all, kind of thing. So, you know, the reality of these huge performance increases from clipless pedals, they just don't materialize when you actually look at it in the real world, in a lot of cycling disciplines. So,
What did Jared Graves say about the difference between flats and clipless? Was it like 4% or
yeah,
something
three or
like
four.
really ridiculous?
Yeah, 3 to 4%. Yeah, that's, you know, for people again, I don't know, that was a, I didn't start out thinking that flats were better. I still don't know if flats are better than clipless. But anyways, point is, like, I didn't set out to try to prove anything. I set out to try to figure out how clipless pedals work so I could design better training programs to enhance how they work. Like, that's literally what started me on this journey, was, okay, clipless pedals are better. How do they work? And I couldn't find a lot of find any research that really backed up these things that I was hearing. So I had an opportunity when I was working with the Yeti team to talk with Jared Graves, who, you know, a BMX badass, multi-time four cross and dual slalom world champion in the mountain biking world, won the Enduro World Series a
He's a
couple years.
monster,
He's a monster.
really.
He's proven at every level. He's a monster. And he just kind of, you know, I was asking him and another guy about the flat pedals and clipless pedals, and he just, like, nonchalantly goes, "Eh, it's kind of overblown. Clipless pedals aren't that big a deal. They give me like maybe 3 or 4%." And like I said, he was so nonchalant about it that it just blew my mind, really. I was like, here's this guy who, if anyone in the mountain biking world is going to benefit from clipless pedals, it's this guy. And he pretty much is like, they're not that big a deal. And you give me flats and I'll still kick your ass, buddy. You know, and I was like, something's wrong here. And that's what kind of led me on this whole crazy journey to, you know, becoming the flat pedal guy. But yeah, that was, yeah, exactly. Jared Graves said like 3 or 4%, which, again, I think that people are going to hear that and then they go, well, it's still 3 or 4%, James. You know, for my Strava time, I'm really trying to get that king of the mountain on my local trail, and that 3 or 4% could help. And it's like, man, you know, you're not getting it. Like, there's drawbacks to riding clipless pedals all of the time. And you know, I think that's one of the things that people miss, is I've never said, like, don't ride clipless pedals. It's what basically what you keep saying, which is, like, develop on flats. And then if you feel the need, which you may not feel the need, but if you still feel the need, then you can go to clipless pedals and you'll use them properly. And you'll find that a lot of pros, that's what's happened, because they've spent so much time as kids riding flats. Like, that's the thing. Like, you don't see, you just see the pro. You don't see the 20 to 30 years of cycling experience that preceded that. And you just try to jump in with, like, oh, well, the pro's doing this. And it's like, dude, you don't have his 30 years of cycling experience. Yeah.
Exactly.
So,
Couldn't say it better.
yeah. So anyways, man, yeah, I'll stop. I'll get off my soapbox about, you know, flats and clipless pedals. But it's just, it's really interesting to talk to different cycling coaches that have experienced the same thing in their sports, which is that it can be overblown and even potentially harmful, kind of this attitude that clipless pedals are better all the time for everyone. So cool, man. So I guess, kind of moving on, I want to talk a little bit before I let you go about just some basic strength stuff, man. I think that again, riders get confused about, you know, well, you know, how strong do I need to be? Do I need to be, you know, like a power lifter, or, you know, what's the deal? So I guess, kind of, you know, tell us what you found to be some of the most effective strength training exercises for cyclists, and I guess kind of what you found to, you know, strong to be strong enough for to be a good rider.
Yeah, that's a interesting, really interesting area, and I can say that I put a lot of thought in it, and to make it sure that we aren't like power lifters or even Olympic lifters, and you need to be strong, but it's quite a bit of less than what you see like people who've been going to a gym for like 10 years. For example, we've been talking about BMX racing, which is really about power and putting the power down to the pedals. And I had a discussion with one of the national level coaches from New Zealand, and he basically said that for an elite level rider, you want to be able to front squat 1.5 times your body weight. That's about it. And at a time, I had like 5 kilos, 10 pounds to go. I got that. Then I added maybe 20 or 25 kilos to that. Didn't see any difference on a bike. So, but my like the transfer from the gym to the bike after a certain point, it just diminishes. But you want to be like, how do I say? Strong in an appropriate level, which means like actually the strength standards you put on your side a few years back, like doing a body weight one repetition maximum with 1/3 of your body weight, double body weight deadlift, something like that. That's really on the high, pretty much on the high end.
Yeah,
You
I've kind
want
of
to be
found that
strong, you
too.
want to be move well, but you don't have to be a power lifter.
No.
And add a decent amount of mobility on top of that, and you're pretty much set. And after that, or even after that, it comes down to the sport specific skills. I like training a lot in the gym. I play a lot with different types of training modalities when it comes to like body weight stuff, gymnastics type of stuff on rings, Olympic lifting, barbells, anything like that. I really like doing it. So if I wanted to train just to get better on my bike, I could train like 1/3 that I'm training right now. But it's another hobby for me in a way, another sport even kind of, even though I don't compete in it. So for example, a friend of mine who can barely deadlift like 100 kilos, which isn't much, he could lift probably a lot more if he'd had like a proper coaching and instructed on the lifting side. He hasn't done that already, but he can smoke me on the BMX race gate. So it's interesting to say at least. So sport specific skills, they're in top notch, like the most important thing after you have the basics down, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I think I was actually talking with my chiropractor about this morning, that how sports specific skill and really on top of that is strength, right? Like I think the more times you do a movement, the stronger you're going to get with it. So when you've done 10,000 reps of a movement, even if you've never done quote unquote strength training, you've significantly increased your strength in that sports specific movement. And so you can use strength training though to fast forward that process. So your buddy that can smoke you, does he have like a more reps than you? Is he got a bigger like a longer background doing it, or like maybe more? I don't know, I'm just kind of curious in hearing that.
Not longer background, but I think he's got a bit of talent as well. Although,
Oh
like the I really believe in practice and even more in deliberate practice. But
yeah.
at one point, like at
Yeah,
times, he's just gotten like really fast and really quickly. And I can't, explain it any other way.
what? I mean, that's actually a good point too, is the factor that genetics play in it. And again, I think that this, a lot of riders, how do I put this? Like, you're just gonna have to accept that things didn't line up for you to become a world champion, and if that's the case, then you can kind of just take a deep breath and relax and not feel this crazy pressure to have to like improve and be this like great rider within 2 to 3 years. I feel like so many riders come into especially mountain biking and they feel that like, man, if I'm not like a one of the best riders in my group in 2 to 3 years. Like, I suck, you know, like I'm something's wrong with me. And it's like, man, you know, there's so many things. There's a book called The Sports Gene. I don't know if you,
That's an awesome book. Excellent read.
So good, man, because it does such a good job of balancing the whole 10,000 hour rule, which is funny because the 10,000 hours was an average, which means that nobody was at 10,000 hours, right? Like, that was the average. It means that there were people who were less than 10,000 hours, and there were people who were significantly more than 10,000 hours. So, but you have this idea of like practice being able to be the central thing, but man, sometimes you can't overcome genetics and also like location, right? Like Nino Schurter, like growing up in Switzerland, it's like if that dude grew up in Nebraska, he wouldn't be the cross country world champion that he is, you know? Like even if he has this exact same genetics and everything else, because he wouldn't have the opportunity and the environment. So there's so many things that go into, like I was touching on earlier, like you see the champion, but you don't see the 30 years that preceded that and everything that went into it. And so, you know, as a rider, you're much better off just kind of approaching it, especially when you're first starting out, like you're a kid, you know, not a pro, like you're a kid. And what does a kid need to do? Learn their skills, you know, work, ride, it's work on basic strength and mobility. So yeah, man, no,
And
I
wanna add to that as a rider, I'm average at most in most cases. So for example, in BMX racing, I've had a couple of good results, but I've had to struggle quite a bit to just improve a bit. And I know when it comes to talent, every bit of talent that I have, it's on the endurance side. So like the power development, speed kind of stuff, it's been a struggle for me, and it's been a learning experience, and hopefully I can help others get better through that, since I've really had to like dig up all the stones and look from like everywhere. So that's like a it's been like an interesting journey. And same comes to, you know, bike handling skills and technique when it comes to like mountain biking. I didn't get like any coaching like before. I'd been riding for more like 10 years, and there's a lot of wrong stuff to unlearn at that point.
No, that's what makes you a good coach though, man, because that's you know, the people that have had to struggle and earn what they've gotten. I mean, I tell people all the time, like I wasn't a natural rider. I still remember wrecking my bike trying to jump off a curb. And I mean, dude, it was so embarrassing, man. Just ditched it or freaking wrecked right in front of a car. Anyways, but yeah, you know, you got to struggle and earn it, but that's what makes you a good coach and able to help people. And yeah, when you get those talented guys, I don't know, I joke around, like when I was working with Aaron Gwynn, I tell people like the best thing I did was not get that guy hurt. You know, like when you get an uber talent in, honestly, as a coach, like you one should be humble and realize like, hey man, I'm, you know, this was lucky I got this guy. I'm not some genius. And two, don't hurt this guy. So, but, so yeah, man, no, I think that's all good stuff.
I need to cut you on this one. So one of the like the big things I learned one time when visiting you at the Grand Junction was the exact conversation about Aaron Quinn. And I think you said from like word to word that when you get an athlete like that, the most important thing is not to mess him up. I was like, okay, gotta keep that in mind.
Man, don't mess them up. So I mean, if you're for sure, so I can't even tell you how many, you know, potential world champions we never heard about because some coach got a hold of them and thought that he would make them better and ended up getting them hurt somewhere along the way. So yeah, if you're a coach listening to this, definitely wise words. And I didn't come up with that. That's frick, I've heard that from like guys like, I think Mike Boyle was the guy who originally started bringing that to my attention because he would talk about when he was training the Boston Bruins and how he had to realize real quickly that, you know, these guys are million-dollar athletes and I can't get them hurt. So I'm not going to be doing heavy back squats. Like that was one of the things that got him off of heavy back squats is realizing like, you know, the risk to benefit ratio for this exercise just isn't what it needs to be. For this situation. And so, but anyways, yeah, good advice for anyone working with athletes.
Yeah, I relayed that in the King Stretch course. The instructor, head instructor Andrea Spina, he had a poll like, who here trains world level tennis, world class tennis players? One or two like lift their hands, and then he asked, do you have them do snatches with a barbell? And even like before he finished the question, he said that I'm gonna punch you in the face. Yeah, the message was pretty much the same.
Yeah. I mean, you get that Dan John's another guy
Yeah.
who harps on that all the time, man. Just like let the athletes play their sport, try and fill in the gaps with their strength and mobility training. Don't try to do too much, man. Don't be a freaking super genius. But that's usually what gets the best results. So well, cool, man. Well, shoot, we've been chatting for a while. I know it's kind of late where you're at, and definitely appreciate your time. Anything else you wanna touch on or talk about before I let you go?
Well, time really flies when you're having a good discussion. Well, at the moment, nothing comes to mind. There's always like bunch of stuff when later on, but at the moment, I'm pretty happy with this one.
Good, man. Yeah. Well, we'll definitely have you back on and get your thoughts on some more stuff. Like I said, I mean, you guys can check out Yuka's got has he's got a freaking laundry list of credentials here. Recently got your master's in mechanical engineering. So I guess that congratulations on that. I know it took you a little while
Thank
to
you.
work
Thank you
through
very
that.
much.
So but yeah, so you can check out all of his different credentials. You've got a website. It's super-sets.com.
Yeah.
It's mainly in Finnish though. There's a couple of articles in English that I'll have linked to on the site that you can check out. But man, I don't have a huge Finnish audience, but you'd be surprised. The Bike James podcast and website get around. So if anyone in Finland's listening to this, definitely look Yuka up and check out his blog. And yeah, he's definitely the guy to go to for any sort of cycling stuff in that
Yeah,
country.
and
So.
we can add my email address in the end as well. I'm more than happy to have a discussion with like anyone who's interested about riding, training, and combining the two.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so if you want to tell people what that is, and I'll include it in the bio there.
Definitely.
So cool. So yeah, what is that? Where can they reach you at?
It's my first name dot last name. At gmail.com. So jukkamaininen@gmail.com.
All right, excellent. Yeah, well, people probably have to go to the site to look that one up. So like you said, that's a tough one even for Finnish people sometimes. Well, cool, man. And I guess that's about it, man. I've really enjoyed catching up with you, and like I said, it's been good conversing with you over the years and just kind of staying up with your career and where things are going. So yeah, man, appreciate you taking the time to come on and share some thoughts with us.
My pleasure. It was an honor. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So well, cool. We'll definitely get you back on again. So once again, this has been James Wilson. You guys can check me out at bikejames.com. Got a bunch of cool free stuff you can sign up for there. Good podcasts like this one and videos and other stuff just to help you be a better rider. And so I hope you guys have enjoyed this podcast, and I'll talk to you in the next one.